Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1:40, that's Pacific Summer Time. Today is August 12th, and of course it's Friday, so it's the big picture long-term audio for the various different asset classes. And if we have a review of what's been happening this week, then stock markets have generally been quite firm, but closing out the week pretty quiet on Wall Street, with the Dow down just a tad, the S&P down just a tad, and the Nasdaq up just a little bit. But of course, that doesn't do anything to overshadow the fact that all three hit new all-time, well, not all-time, but highs yesterday on the same day for the first time since 1999. And that does give us pause, and certainly it's something that we should consider in terms of where we are in the broad market cycle. But elsewhere this week, the Chinese market had pulled back quite sharply on Wednesday and Thursday, and then it was up today almost 2%. And that CSI 300 is closing in on the 3300 area. It hasn't been above 3300 in a year, and it has pulled back from that area on a number of occasions. But this continues to look like a base formation, and something that I've repeated in a number of the audios over the last few months is that there looks to be evidence that the administration in China are defending the 3000 level on the CSI 300. And that's the index that has got the futures on it. So that is perhaps, you know, when we look at the US and the S&P 500 has gained in importance over the last number of decades because it is the most actively traded futures market, then the CSI 300 is probably in the same position for China, where it has the future, and the, for example, the Shanghai A-share index or a number of the other indices do not have futures attached, so they'll remain important benchmarks, but they'll probably wane in importance over time. And with the futures, of course, the CSI 300 represents an index that is easier at least to manipulate for the administration, and it does look like we are in the process of potentially breaking out. And that's a common theme, that China has largely been lagging, mainland China at least, whereas the majority of markets in Asia have been in robust form, not just this week, but over the last couple of months. And that's particularly the case with the Hang Seng, which has broken back above its 200-day moving average and actually did that last month and has been improving on that performance. And the H-share index that's Chinese or mainland Chinese companies listed in Hong Kong broke its progression of lower rally highs last week and has improved on that performance as well. But it isn't just China, but when we look at India, it's the Nifty has staged a rather impressive rebound for most of the year to date, and it is approaching a previous area of resistance around the 9,000 on the Nifty. But in the absence of a break in the progression of higher reaction lows, there would be no real reason to question that that's going to be anything other than a temporary area of resistance. When we look at a number of the ASEAN markets, their defining characteristic is that those markets were in real trouble last year because their currencies had been depreciating so quickly, and foreign investors had been pulling money out of those markets. But it's a rather different story this year, because it all began with Indonesia, I think it was last October, announcing that it was going to support the rupiah, and that was the beginning of the end of the bear market. And it was a cyclical bear market for some of these markets within an overall bullish environment over the lengthy medium to long term. And not least because these are the countries that really do represent the emerging middle class. And that's not a short-term theme. You know, when you have such compelling demographics, and then, you know, there is nothing short of war is going to retard the ability of young people to get older and to enter their most productive phases, you know, in their 20s, where they have boundless energy and are looking for work. And that's something that we're seeing right across India in particular, but it's right across the ASEAN markets. They do have this di demographic dividend. And what they also have is improving governance. And that those two long-term themes combining together are very encouraging indeed. And when then you have the fact that their currencies look increasingly likely that they have bottomed for at least the medium term, then the potential for those markets to really enhance shareholder value becomes rather compelling. And of course, this has also been a rather interesting week for Europe, where a number of the main indices, and particularly in Northern Europe, have broken their progressions of lower rally highs. And it isn't really just Germany, which is a total return index, but one can look, for example, at Belgium or the Netherlands, and you get a pretty similar story that those indices are closing at the upper side of ranges that have been in evidence for much of this year. And they are now trading back above their respective 200-day moving averages. But it isn't quite the same when you look at, for example, the Italian or the Spanish indices. They haven't rebounded quite as emphatically. They still have these progressions of lower rally highs, and they're being weighed down by their banking sectors, and particularly Italy, because and I remember when I had been going over to Italy to give talks while at Bloomberg, talking to people, and that they'd been selling reverse convertibles to retail clients in Italy, and I was rather amazed by that, that little old ladies could be sold such highly complicated and highly leveraged investments. But that is indeed the case, and now that is really coming back to bite them, because the retail customer owns an awful lot of junior debt. And if the banking sector is going to follow the rules that the European Commission and the ECB have instituted, then the junior bondholders are going to be bailed in much the same way that bondholders and equity holders were bailed in the defaults that happened in Cyprus. But of course, Italy is a much larger country than Cyprus is. It's a, not only is it one of the founding members of the EU, but it's in the G7, or at least on the borders of the G7. So that's an altogether different prospect, and that represents a cloud over Italy, and not least because the economy is stagnating, and it is 50-50, and I suspect perhaps the odds are actually less, even less than that, in favor of let me put that in more distinct terms. I think it's unlikely that the Italians are going to vote for the reform of their political system that Renzi has based his political future on. And that opens up an additional can of worms, because that means that we're going to have another election in Europe, and then it could quite possibly be framed around the lines of whether Italy should stay within the euro or not, because we can see that governance is quite clearly improving in the UK, having they haven't quite activated Article 50 yet of the Lisbon Treaty, but or the I'm not sure, in fact, that it is the Lisbon Treaty, but they haven't yet begun the negotiations for their exit, but we can see already what the UK has in store in terms of its governance and what it anticipates that it is likely to do now that it has full control of its future back in London. And certainly the pound is weak, and it is now, I think, among the weakest currencies in the world, and that's certainly needed right now because of the threat of recession that you have in the UK in the short term. But the potential for governance to improve and trade links to be re-established with its global partners, then there is the potential for the UK to come out of all of this in much better form than the Eurozone. And then when other countries see that, and they see that the problems that they have to accept as a result of their, as the price of membership for the EU, that represents a threat. And that represents a threat to the global order, because the euro is the second largest reserve currency. And they not only have these internal problems and conflicts, but they're also faced with the prospect that the currency is quite a bit more strong than they might like. And it's a direct response to negative interest rates. So the UK has now engaged in quantitative easing, and the ECB is in many respects giving with one hand and taking with the other, because negative interest rates are deflationary, but quantitative easing is inflationary. And Japan is doing something quite similar, but the net effect is that they're flooding the market with liquidity. The Chinese are also in printing mode, both fiscally and monetarily. And with that as a background, the likelihood of the Fed raising rates in an aggressive manner is practically off the table. And even the prospect of one interest rate hike this year is still questionable. If that is indeed the case, then we are in an environment where we have massive monetary and fiscal expansion. There is the very strong likelihood that Mario Draghi will finally succeed in convincing the Europeans that they need to adopt a fiscal expansion, and whoever wins the election in the US this year is likely to pursue some form of fiscal expansion as well. Therefore, what we may not have is global synchronized economic expansion, but what we do have is synchronized global monetary and fiscal expansion. And in many respects, the impact on asset prices is much the same. Whether we get the same knock-on effect in GDP growth is quite another a question entirely. And in fact, if we look back at what it is that quantitative easing has done, it has been phenomenally positive for asset prices and has really not done very much for GDP growth at all. But we're in a position where central banks are casting around for solutions. And if they indeed do conclude, and it is really quite likely that they will eventually conclude that negative interest rates don't work, then the next item on the agenda would be some form of helicopter money, which is directly inflationary. And then we could have an inflation bias to asset prices once more. Well, then the kinds of assets that perform are stock markets, and stock markets are most definitely performing. We do have some short-term overbought conditions, and a news headline like we had yesterday that the three main Wall Street indices are breaking to new highs on the same day for the first time since the bubble peak in 1999 will certainly have some people questioning where are we in the cycle. And it is probably worth considering that there are three psychological perception stages to a major bull market. And disbelief is the first one, and that was certainly evident in 2009 and even into 2010. Then we transitioned into acceptance, where people really did get the message that as long as the Fed was engaged in quantitative easing, that asset prices would rise. And that pretty much ended in 2015. And now we're moving into a phase where interest rates could stay lower for longer, and then longer than most people had ever considered possible. And that just about every central bank, with the clear exception of the Fed, is cutting interest rates and printing money. And so there is no shortage of liquidity. And liquidity is both global and fungible. So printed in one country can certainly help to inflate asset prices somewhere else. That is at least part of the reason that we're seeing Wall Street outperform. But of course, because we have such low interest rates and because we have such low government bond yields, then the ability of companies to borrow and then to use their cash piles in a financial engineering way, well, they have a great incentive to do that, not least because interest rates are so very low and the cost of debt is considerably below the cost of equity. But because they have such large cash piles and they can borrow against them, then they have the ability to transfer some of that cash into the debt markets, which allows them, or at least it takes away a target for governments to introduce new taxes. There are, I think, when we look at the very real evidence that we have of significant themes to stoke a bull market, such as the revolution that we're having in the energy markets, the expansion of the global middle class, where we could have upwards of 2 billion additional new consumers in the next 2 decades, and the continued march of technological innovation. And that is really helping to improve the performance of stocks and certainly for the primary companies concerned, those that have the really undeniable global franchises. Well, they're benefiting enormously from all three of those themes. So what are indeed the risks? Well, the risks are that governments will either attack them because they need the money. And to a certain extent, they have been very active in financial repression within the banking sector and the insurance sector, where they have insisted that both banks and insurance companies and now money market funds are forced to buy government paper. But they haven't yet introduced new taxes on the corporate sector to harvest the large cash reserves that these companies have, and not least because they're hard to get to, because most of them are offshore. But we can't discount the possibility that that won't eventually happen entirely, and not least if we have continued moves towards additional cooperation on the tax front between countries. Well, the additional risk is antitrust. Particularly when we look at companies like Amazon or Google, and where they have a clearly dominant position, then, not least where the potential fates of competitors within their respective sectors is so dim that of course we know that capitalism trends towards consolidation, and we have had a great deal of consolidation. A great example of that is Kraft Heinz, where Kraft split itself up into Mondelez and Kraft, and Heinz was bought by Warren Buffett and partners, and so was Kraft, and then recombined. So then you go from having two to three to two companies, and yet the market has expanded mightily. These are kinds of consumer-oriented shares that tend to do very well in an environment where the global middle class is doing well. And yet the pace of M&A activity is only accelerating, because if you were in any way worried about interest rates rising any time in the future, then harvesting low interest rates such as they are today makes a great deal of sense. Well, when we look at that consolidation, then the logical question, of course, is at what point does ownership of key financial assets all over the world become a liability for companies? And how Amazon can deal with its dominance of the retail sector, which is only accelerating as the reliance of mobile for retail becomes an increasingly pervasive trend, then that's going to be a very key lesson as to just how well that they can do that. And I don't think that that's a short-term threat, but it is an outlier that could potentially be a problem for some of the autonomies, which by and large have been among the better performers in the last 5 or 6 years, but continue to do well because of their focus on the consumer base, and they may not be the originators of new technology, but they certainly benefit as customers of it, and they also benefit from lower energy prices. And of course, this week was rather interesting because oil prices are now up about $6 off their low at the beginning of August. And we're up an additional $1.20 on WTI and $1.14 on Brent crude today. So that's breaking back above the 200-day moving average. And then a clear downward dynamic would be required to check this rather impressive rebound. But we've had a very deep decline. We've had a very impressive rally. And now we've had the first bigger consolidation. The consistency from and the short covering rally that took place, which delivered that very consistent trend, is now over. And now the big question is to what extent oil prices can rally from here. Certainly, Saudi Arabia has been quite vocal in saying that they want a steadier market, and not least because they were the ones who engineered this decline and were probably surprised by its severity. And of course, Saudi Arabia is fighting a war on three fronts, and obviously that doesn't come cheap. They rather need the money, and the bigger thy neighbor policy that it had by engineering the decline in order to rob Iran of additional oil revenues has probably backfired in some respects. So we can anticipate that oil prices are going to be volatile, but they are swinging upwards at the present moment. And when we look at this at energy prices, and we look at energy over the long term, then the likelihood of oil prices getting back up to $100 is looking very unlikely indeed. And if we look at oil prices over the very long term, and the chart in the chart library is OILPHIST. It's only updated once a month, but it goes back to 1900. I think it goes back to the late 1800s in terms of oil pricing. And what it gives us is a step sequence uptrend, and the steps can last for anything up to 20 years. And arguably, we're in one of those now that the price has pulled back to give or take about between $30 and $40, which was the upper side of the underlying range. And it's very unlikely that prices can go very much below the $20 area for the simple reason that so much of the additional supply required to feed the global economy is just plainly uneconomic at that level. But so much of it becomes economic in the region of $60. And there was news today that Mexico was quietly hedging its 2017 production when prices were up there around $50 in early July. So, and that does help to indicate that, where is the break even for a lot of producers? And it is in the $50 to $60 area. So if they're willing to sell additional supply at those levels, it gives us an indication of where their break evens are. And when prices are well below that level, then supply starts to get taken out of the market and prices begin to find support. So that's a recipe for a range. That's a recipe for an environment where we could have very volatile ranging. And so far, there's no question. There's nothing to question that that's not going to be the case, and we could have very volatile trading in oil prices for the foreseeable future, because we have had just incredible technological innovation in terms of both renewable technology, in terms of fourth and fifth generation nuclear technology, which really is completely different to the kinds of nuclear plants that were built 30 and 40 years ago. And perhaps most exciting of all is storage capacity. Now, we've had a substantial rally in lithium-related assets, and that's not least because of the success of Tesla in promoting electric cars. And of course, the batteries for electric cars are considerably larger than the one that goes in your handheld device. So they require much more lithium. And the Gigafactory that Tesla is building, and they anticipate to begin producing from in the third quarter, so it's going to be probably September or October, then they anticipate hitting full capacity in the next 3 or 4 years. And that alone would represent a massive call on lithium demand. But lithium is really only the technology that we have right now. And there is a massive push on to develop new battery technologies. And it really has been the obstacle to alleviating the intermittency problem of renewable tech like solar and wind. And if we can crack that nut, then the potential for energy prices to come down a lot and stay down, which would represent a massive tailwind for economic growth overall, would be the most likely scenario. When we talk about this being a liquidity-fueled bull market, then when we think about the psychological perception stages, I personally believe that we are entering the third psychological perception stage of this bull market, that there is so much money sloshing around, and that attempting to rationalize the market is simply not working. Because if you're a rational actor, you would look at these markets and you would say that cyclically adjusted PEs are among the highest ever, that corporate profits have been falling for 6 consecutive months, retail sales just today were coming in below expectations, and that leverage ratios have increased once more, that the issuance of covenant light bonds, despite the fact that everyone swore they would never touch them again, issuance has been hitting new highs for the last 3 consecutive years. And you would conclude that this overall is a risky environment. And yet, stock markets continue to hit new highs. And that is characteristic. That is, in fact, the defining characteristic of the third psychological perception stage, because it's where you get a mania. And manias are not about rationality. Manias are about irrationality. They're about an acceptance of contradiction. And we are getting to a point where people will start to think that PEs don't matter, that a higher valuation is justified by the fact that bond yields are so low. And bond yields are low. When we think about how low they are, then there's a substantial proportion of all the sovereign bonds in the world now have negative yields. And US Treasury yields are still pretty close to their all-time lows. And the bond market today was stronger by an additional point on the long bond. It is trading at 173. And that's for a contract that redeems at par. That's pricing in a great deal of, well, the one way to interpret it is that it's pricing in a lot of deflation. But of course, what it's actually pricing in is a great deal of government interference in the market. And I think that that is a rather clear distinction because, okay, we are getting deflationary pressures coming from the technology sector. But we are getting inflation in asset prices. And it isn't just stocks, it's also property. So what we have had is a very spotty economic recovery where anything that is dependent on asset prices improving continues to do well. And the Fed is unlikely to really be aggressive in raising rates until wage growth takes off. And wage growth has not yet taken off. It broke out last year, so they raised rates once. It has not broken out again. If it does so, then we can anticipate that the Fed would raise rates pretty soon afterwards. But with retail sales coming in below expectations, then there's less need for that. Now, if we're going to have low interest rates and we're going to have excess leverage and a lot of leverage. And I guess the other way to think about it is that it's never excess leverage until things start going against your position. But we have a lot of leverage in the system, and we have governments that have got a great deal of debt. Then they do need to inflate that away. But those are medium-term considerations. And in the short term, what we have is an environment where stocks are really quite favorable, because shares have the potential to increase their dividends. And in an environment where you have negative interest rates, having an asset that has an increasing dividend and a competitive yield to boot is a very powerful, a convincing factor for people to get invested in the stock market. And then there is the potential that we get equity yields compressing to close that spread. We've had spreads relative to benchmark bonds compressing for much of the year. That's been the case for sovereign bonds. It's been a case particularly for Eurozone bonds, but also for emerging market bonds. And if it can happen in the bond market, there is no reason to anticipate that it cannot happen also in the stock market. So the potential for yields to compress would have to be the base case, as long as we have a period of fiscal and monetary expansion. And that is pretty much all over the world. Well, then that is the recipe for equity prices to advance. And not because of a fundamental cause, but because of a monetary cause and a leverage cause. And again, that is symptomatic of the third psychological perception stage. Now, we know how it ends. It will end ugly, and it could end in a crash. But there's no evidence of that yet. We are not yet at a point where the supply of liquidity is going to be inhibited. And in fact, that supply of liquidity has the potential to accelerate. And that would certainly be the case if central banks go the helicopter money route. Well, when we think about it in those terms, then gold prices should be appreciating. But gold had done very well in the beginning of the year. And what it has been confined to is a range for much of the last couple of months. Now, gold prices are currently around 1,335, and the moving average is more like 1,250. So gold might yet have some additional consolidation to do. And if gold is going to continue to consolidate, well, that might act as an additional inhibitor for some of the gold-related equities, some of the gold-related metals. So platinum today was down 27, and that's broken the short-term progression of higher reaction lows. Palladium really did, was an absolute head fake this week, where it surged higher on Wednesday, pulled back even more sharply on Thursday, and was down additionally in here today, down about $5. Well, and copper was down today, and so was nickel. So that suggests that we're getting some pressure in the for additional consolidation in the precious metal markets. But those are short-term considerations, because the more important medium-term consideration is that gold has broken a lengthy progression of lower rally highs, that it has so far continued to find support in the region of the moving average, and that until it sustains a move below the moving average, there is no reason to question that it isn't a medium-term bull market environment. But that does not mean that this is perhaps the best time to be buying. The best time, of course, would be when it has completed a reversion to the mean. And by waiting, personally, I am waiting. But of course, that is to risk the potential that it doesn't complete a reversion to the mean and breaks out. Well, we'll have to see how that goes. But overall, I think the argument for having at least some gold as a hedge against the manipulation of markets that central banks have been engaged in for much of the last decade is really well made. So having watching gold and how that performs is likely to be an important thing to do. And the other thing to watch in terms of the bond markets is the total return indices, because you only get so much information from looking at yield or looking at price, because bond investors are total return investors, and therefore you should really look at the total return on bonds, because it's a 35-year bull market, and that has meant that the total return on bonds has been going up for an awfully long time. And when it eventually turns, that is going to represent some incredibly painful decisions for particularly pension funds and anyone who has been forced by governments to own these bonds, because nobody has been complaining about having to buy more government bonds while the government itself has been buying them too. It will be quite another story when bond prices eventually roll over and banks and insurance companies are still locked into buying them. Then you will have some serious trouble. But of course, there's no evidence of that yet. These are really attempts to prognosticate and to think about what could be the influences that could derail what is an otherwise bull market environment. And when we do have this continued advance, then there is the potential that European companies might do better from so much liquidity being available, whereas European governments are likely to remain under pressure. And I think I would really focus on European companies that have got large global franchises, because regardless of what currency they are denominated in, then they should continue to hold their value and even appreciate. And because we are in a bull market environment overall, there is currently some bargain hunting going on. And I've talked in previous audios about the biotech sector and about the cybersecurity sector, and now we're seeing that the retail sector, despite the fact that it is waging a losing war against Amazon, we're seeing that lengthy, and I think in the case of, for example, Macy's or Nordstrom, they trended lower just about all of the last year, but they've now broken their progressions of lower rally highs. So there is some bargain hunting kind of starting to creep into even assets that perhaps do not have secular bull market characteristics to them, but rather that they represent things that are deeply oversold and have the potential to bounce in an otherwise bullish environment. When we look at the Dow and the S&P and the Nasdaq, they are short-term overbought, and we expect that when they have broken up out of ranges. That doesn't mean that they won't consolidate. And as long as they hold their breakouts, then we can give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. And I think with that, I'm going to leave you for today, and I'm going to wish all the best to all of you.